Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to In Search Of. We're your host, Ashton and Sam. We're two accountants who binge podcasts by day and TV by night. Keep listening to find what you've been in search of. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Ashton.
So our episode today, we don't really have a name yet, but it's podcast turned into TV shows. So you've probably seen lots of TV lately based off, if you listen to podcasts, I mean, there's a whole list of them. We've got, what are some other ones that we're not doing? What's the big one, like one of the first ones that came out? Has Connie, whatever her name is.
Connie Britton.
Mm-hmm. Which one was that?
Dirty John. Oh my gosh.
Dirty John. Yeah, that I feel like that was one of the first ones that came out. But yeah, there's, we're doing, Sam's doing Dr. Death. I'm doing the thing about Pam. I'm trying to think. I feel like there's a lot more.
You were going to do The Shrink Next Door.
Yes, I was going to do The Shrink Next Door, but Wondery, you have to... like pay to listen to that, which I don't.
It's weird.
I know. I listened to it back in the day.
Something that we're watching right now is
The Staircase. No,
because that was was that?
I don't think there's really a. I don't think there's a main podcast about that one.
No,
I think you're right.
But
anyways, yeah, there's a lot out there, so we decided to. Do cover some podcasts that are covered or that have been turned into TV shows, and then we chose a TV show that was a book, which is The Anatomy of Scandal. So I think you and I kind of have some different opinions on Anatomy of Scandal. Mm-hmm. I liked it. You weren't the biggest fan of it.
I didn't dislike it, but I thought it was boring, and like halfway through I lost interest, and like I kept playing in the background and I finished it, but I was not like, it wasn't captivating to me.
Yeah, I could see that. It's a little slow, but I think it's going to get good. There's a second season.
Oh,
so
really?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a second. They kind of left a cliffhanger, so I feel like there's got to be a second season. Basically what happens, and I love UK TV. I don't know why. I'm just like, I just love the, any kind of UK TV show, I'm totally into it. It's the weirdest like niche that I'm into. But basically he's like a prime minister. Is that what he is?
Sort of politician.
Yeah.
In England.
Yeah. And he gets accused of raping one of his employers, which he had an affair with. So there's kind of the whole question of like, was this rape or was this just a continuation of the affair?
Yeah.
So there's this whole thing. Well, then you come to learn that the lawyer who was prosecuting him, I guess, raped her, but she kind of like changed her identity. Mm-hmm. So they don't really recognize her. And so she kind of has like a personal thing against him. Also, I don't think that's allowed, but like she doesn't say anything. Also, I think their whole, like the way they get dressed up in court, is really funny.
The wigs. Hair thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, is that really necessary? Do they need
I don't
to
know.
Do that?
I don't
because
know.
I feel like I take them less seriously when I'm like, you are wearing a curly white wig.
I know. I wonder if they do that to try to, like, put everybody on the same playing field. I don't know. I don't really yeah. understand that. Mm. But anyways, so you learn that the guy, you think he's, like, this good guy at first, but then you kind of learn he has his, like, dark past. And his wife is Sienna Miller. And the woman who plays the lawyer, she's in another show on Netflix that I thought looked good. I can't remember what it was called. But it's a pretty good show.
That show, because I looked this up also.
Yeah, and I was interested in watching that show, but I haven't done that yet. But and then basically another thing that happens while they're in college is the guy that is accused of rape, his friend was doing drugs, and he's like, okay, we need to come home. So he takes his friend and puts the drugs in his pocket, and they leave. Well, when they're leaving, like, they go down the stairs and they leave. Well, the guy he was doing the drugs with, like, is high on drugs and jumps from the building and, like, kills himself. Well, he's like, the main guy tells his friend, he's like, we gotta go, like, we can't be here. So they basically, like, left the scene of a crime scene. And he later realizes he has the drugs in his pocket and, like, throws it away. And so, it's this whole big thing, and his girlfriend at the time was his wife, who became his wife later, and he kind of tells her what happens. I think he leaves out some details. So, it's kind of this drama just plays out where she's like, you know, you haven't been honest to me about these certain things. So, she leaves him, and then at the end of the movie, or the show, she outs him for that. So, it's this whole big, you know, they get, him and his friend get taken into jail, and they're both like, you know, in the political world, and so it's good. I mean, it is slow. It's really short, though. There's only, like, 6 episodes.
Yeah, and I guess I just felt like I could see where everything was going, and nothing felt like a cliffhanger to me. I was like, okay, okay, I don't know. But the judge is, her name is Michelle Dockery, and I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but she was in Defending Jacob on Apple TV.
Oh, that's right.
And that was also a book that
was
turned into a show and has Chris Evans in it, and I really liked that. It's a like a crime.
I never finished that, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah. But no, that's not the movie. The show I'm talking about is on Netflix right now.
Okay.
And it's like something new that they just dropped, and it's not really probably what I would normally be into because it's kind of like a Western, but it looks interesting. So I might.
Godless?
Yes. Yeah. I'm usually not into that kind of stuff, but we'll see.
Well, I am not into that stuff either, but I watched Yellowstone really, I got into it.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was surprised.
I haven't tried Yellowstone yet, but
it's only on, like,
something random.
Well, I think it was on something random to watch it live, and I wanted to watch it live as the new season was coming out, but I think you can watch old episodes somewhere else. I don't know.
Gotcha. Well, that's our recommendation for TV. Give it a shot. You might not be that into it, but I liked it. I kind of just put it on and cooked dinner. And it, again, it's like one of those shows where you don't have to literally watch every single detail.
Yeah, and it's short. So even if you're like me and you get to the end of it and you're like, okay, well, that wasn't – I didn't love it. But, I mean, I'm not like, oh, I wasted my time watching. So.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, you know, let us know what you think. But, okay, now we have Dr. Death and Think About Pam. So, I'm going to let you go first, Sam, because I think I went last time.
So. Okay. And I know you didn't ever watch this because you don't like watching.
Yes, I forgot to mention that. I don't like watching shows that I already know the story to, which The Staircase is different because I have watched the Netflix documentary and I'm watching the show.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I'm not. I didn't watch Dirty John. I didn't watch Dr. Death. I didn't watch the
Now, Dirty John is
Think
very
About Pam.
cringy. I don't think you should watch that.
Okay.
Dr. Death, I do think is really good.
And what is that on
And
Netflix?
I'm gonna look it up because I
Okay.
think it's Hulu, but I'm not
Oh, yeah, you might
positive.
be right. You might be right. Yeah. So, yeah, the thing about Pam was not good.
Oh,
I was
wait,
in.
no. This is on that Peacock
Oh,
streaming
that's
service
right.
that
Yeah. Okay,
I don't
apparently
know.
that's free, so you can
If you
watch that
have
if you want.
Xfinity, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But I do think it's really good, and it gives you a lot more of. So the podcast talks mostly about his patients, and then a little bit at the end, it explains the trial. But the show is a lot of the trial and the two doctors who are trying to like persecute him,
Take him
and
down.
the yeah, and
Yeah.
the district attorney that is working with them. So it's a lot more of that. So it's not like you're re-watching the podcast like episode by episode. It's very different. And I don't think it's cheesy. So
Okay.
anyway, I think it's worth watching if you're just looking for
I have
something.
Xfinity too, so I'll give it a
Yeah.
shot.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people kind of know the story, but the podcast was produced by Wondery in 2018, and the podcast doesn't really go in chronological order, but I don't think I will be able to tell it very well if I don't go in chronological order. So, hopefully it makes sense, but I'm going to start from like the beginning. So, it's about Christopher Dunch. He was born in Montana, but he grew up in a suburb of Memphis. I actually have a friend who lives in this, like just outside of where he grew up. And it's like a wealthy part of Memphis. And
Okay.
his family was not really wealthy. I think his dad was like a physical therapist and his mom was a missionary or something. So he was not. His like family and he was not as like prominent and wealthy as everybody else in his town, but he kind of gained a name and popularity by playing football. And he wasn't actually like very good at football, but he was like the hardest worker on the team, and like he would practice like longer and harder and run drills like over and over and over. So, like they said, what he lacked in talent, he made up for in motivation. And this is kind of like just how he is, even as a doctor.
Like across the
So,
board.
yeah, which turns out to like be a bad thing,
Yeah,
that he was so like
you have to
stubborn.
actually be like a good doctor. You can't just have like good motivation.
Yeah, you can't just be like, I really am gonna be a good doctor and like not. So he first tried to go to college to play football, but again, because he wasn't all that good at it, that didn't work out. But one of his first college roommates said that he would always be losing things, particularly his keys. And it was like almost every time he like left the house, he was like, I don't know where my keys are. And they would all joke and be like, check the door. And like he would have left his keys in like the lock in the door. And his roommate said we would all joke that like if he ever became a doctor, he would leave something inside of a body because like that's how forgetful he
Oh
was.
my gosh.
And come to find out years later, that's exactly what he does. So he gives up his football dreams, and in 1995, he started med school at the University of Tennessee. And he built a great reputation because, again, he was like very motivated and hardworking and dedicated. But in his residency, he completed less than 100 surgeries. All residents complete over 1,000 surgeries. So he had like no experience, but he had the recommendations and like the positive words from the doctors and everything that he worked with because of his attitude. So he graduated from med school, and in the summer of 2011, he began working at Baylor Plano Medical Center in Texas, which I lived like 20 minutes from there. when I lived in Texas. So it's where, like,
is that like,
it's like northeast a little bit of Dallas.
Okay.
So like a little bit up and a little bit over. So that first year he had 3 botched surgeries on Barry Morgeloff, Robert Passmore, and Kenneth Fennell. All 3 would end up resulting in lawsuits and permanent physical damage to the patients. And later that year, in December of 2011, he wrote an email to his coworker who he was also dating at the time, and he said, quote, "I really am building an empire. Anyone close to me thinks that I am likely something between God, Einstein, and the Antichrist. I'm ready to leave the love and kindness and goodness and patience that I mix with everything else that I am and become a cold-blooded killer." So, I mean, why this didn't, like, raise red flags, I don't know. I guess it was because to his girlfriend, she was still dating him. I don't know.
Yeah, that is not something you ever want just, like, a normal human being to say, especially your doctor.
I know. And he's, like, a neurosurgeon. Like, he's not, like, a physician. He is, like, performing, like, spine surgeries. So, anyway. So in February of 2012, Chris performed neck surgery on his childhood best friend, Jerry Summers. Jerry had an old football injury, and when Jerry woke up, he couldn't move or feel anything from the neck down. So Chris took him back into surgery to, like, correct whatever he thought was wrong from the first one. And Chris ended up removing so much bone from Jerry's neck that his head was not securely attached to his body. Jerry later told his girlfriend that he and Chris had done cocaine the night before surgery, then kind of took that back a little bit, but it was a common rumor that Chris was, like, high on some sort of drugs, like drunk often when he was operating. Jerry became permanently paralyzed, but it's like I think it's called incomplete paralysis because he can't move from the neck down, but he can feel pain. So it's like the worst combination. It's like he can't use his limbs, but he can feel the pain in them.
Yeah, I remember when listening to the story, they were like, he basically decapitated him.
Yes. Like, yeah, his head was, like, basically from the inside. Not attached.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. God.
Uh-huh. Yeah, uh-huh. And they talk to him a lot in this podcast, and he still, like, does not have bad things to say about him.
Oh, my God.
I don't know. I mean, they talked to Jerry's girlfriend also, and he dealt with, like, a lot of anger, which, I mean, understandable, but she said that he kind of took it out on her and, like, would use his wheelchair as, like, a battering ram and, like, slam his body and stuff. So awful. And that was his best friend. So after this surgery, Dunch was temporarily suspended by Baylor Plano, but it was only for a month. And when his suspension was up, he operated on Kelly Martin. She had come in for a simple procedure on her back that should have taken about an hour. It took over 3 hours, and she was in so much pain after the surgery that she had to be sedated. Dunch told her family that there had been some complications, but overall the surgery went fine. But in actuality, her abdomen had filled with blood because Dunch had punctured a major vessel near her spinal cord, and she bled to death in the recovery room.
So she died?
Yes, in the
recovery
room.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I can't remember all the little details.
I know.
Oh my God.
I know.
That's horrible.
So then Dunch decided to resign before Baylor could fire him. But by allowing Dunch to resign rather than firing him, the facility didn't have to report him to the state medical board or report him to the National Practitioner Databank. And this databank keeps a record of, like, bad doctors. So there's a number of reasons you could be put into this databank, and most of them are not so bad to where like you could never practice again, but it does give like a listing of like why doctors were fired and whatever. So Baylor didn't fire him, so they didn't have to report him. And it's mostly like financial reasons why they didn't do this, because if Baylor had reported him, they would have the legal ramifications and the bills and like the malpractice suits and all of that coming towards them. And it's also a possibility that Dunch could sue Baylor. I mean, he wouldn't really have an argument to say that he was fired without cause, but still like going through that litigation and having to prove that what he did, it was just easier for Baylor to not fire him and let him resign. So anyway, that allowed Dunch to keep operating. He kept his medical license, so he could just go, he could leave Baylor and go wherever he wanted to keep operating. So this was 2012. Later in that year, this is where the two kind of main people in the show come in. So Dr. Robert Henderson and Dr. Randall Kirby are the two. One is played by Christian Slater, I think, and the other is played by Alec Baldwin in the show.
Oh, okay.
And they are the two that really fight to get him convicted. So later in 2012 is when Dr. Robert Henderson first really meets Dunch. He had heard of him and like kind of heard these rumors, but this was the first time he like saw and met him in person. So Robert Henderson was a back and spine surgeon, and he had gotten a call from an administrator at Dallas Medical Center. A patient who just had surgery was not doing well and needed corrective surgery. And this admin person was calling to ask Robert Henderson to do it. And Dr. Henderson said that he was usually called by other doctors and surgeons to help. It's usually not admins who are like calling on the behalf of a patient and saying like, we need another doctor here. Like that's not really their job. So this patient who needed help was Mary Eford. She had come in for elective surgery, and Dunch had operated on the wrong part of her back, severed one of her nerve roots, twisted screws and drilled holes in like random parts of her spine, didn't remove the disc he was actually supposed to remove, and he left hardware in her. So he left like random screws and like instruments inside of her.
Oh my God.
She lost a third of her blood. And in the middle of her surgery, he left her on the operating table with her spine exposed to go argue with the hospital staff about a woman he had operated on the day before. So the woman he operated on the day before was named Floella Brown. She was 64 years old. Dunch had severed her vertebral artery and said that during the procedure, there was so much blood that he couldn't see what he was doing. This surgery, like normally, there should not be that much blood. But it was like, there was so much blood, it was like seeping onto the floor, like dripping off the table and onto the floor. So when she was back in the recovery room, she lost consciousness and Dunch was not there. He had left the hospital. Nurses, everybody was calling him like all night. He never answered. When he came in the next morning, he was coming in for Mary Eford's surgery, who we just talked about. People who saw him said that it appeared that he was on, quote, something, meaning drugs. And he was in the same scrubs he had been wearing for the past 3 days, like unwashed. There was like a hole, I think, in the back of them. And that's how they knew that it was the same pair of scrubs. So he came in. He didn't check on Floella, even though, I mean, she had lost consciousness. They had been trying to contact him, and he went straight to Eford's surgery instead. So while he was working on Eford's back, he said that he wanted to do a craniotomy on Floella. Well, he didn't have the privileges, and Dallas Medical Center was not equipped to do a craniotomy. That's like essentially removing part of someone's brain. And so the nurses were like, no, you can't do that. He got angry, and that's when he left Eford's spine open on the table. So, eventually Dunch, so the nurses and like Floella's family were trying to get her transferred to a different hospital. Eventually Dunch said that was fine. But because he had punctured the major artery in her neck and there was no activity found in her brain, she was withdrawn from life support. So that's another patient that has died. So back to Mary Eford and Dr. Henderson. He did the corrective surgery on her and he recorded it because he knew that it would go to litigation for malpractice. He found a screw sticking up through her spinal canal, 3 holes in her spinal column, and saw that a bundle of nerves that controlled her legs had been completely removed. He realized that Dunch was not even operating in the right place, which was like on the wrong disc. And that's when he began to question if Dunch was like actually a doctor. So Dallas Medical Center revoked Dunch privileges there. And again, revoking privileges at a certain facility just means that that doctor can't operate there. They can go anywhere else they want to. So they didn't stop him. They just stopped him from operating there. So then Randall Kirby kind of joined forces with Dr. Henderson. Randall Kirby had worked with Dunch at Baylor Plano. They had done a surgery together and Kirby watched Dunch do it wrong. So he had more, you know, evidence and support to back this case against him. So the next year, 2013, Dunch operated on Jeffrey Glidewell, and he destroyed Glidewell's thyroid gland, cut through his esophagus, drilled a hole in his neck, injured a major artery, and let him bleed profusely. Dunch shoved a sponge in the hole that he drilled to stop the bleeding and sewed Jeffrey up, leaving the sponge inside. Kirby came in after he was, again, like, called to do elective reparative surgery, and he decided that this was criminal level activity and an attempt at murder. So Kirby wrote a letter to the medical board and they revoked Dunch's license. But again, Henderson and Kirby knew that it was possible for him to get it back and for him to keep operating. So they went to the district attorney. The district attorney at first did not really care because again, legally, malpractice has like a cap of, I think it was $250,000. And like pain and suffering, unless there is like a direct, I think, monetary effect of pain and suffering, it's capped at like $250,000. So like if you're paralyzed, it's not a bigger claim than if you just were like, it took longer for you to recover than it was supposed to. So like, it's okay. Not a great thing for lawyers to take on like malpractice. Yeah. It's just not very worth it because there's not a whole lot of money in it. So that was 2013. So March of 2015, so almost 2 years later, the police were called on Dunch while he was beating on the doors of a bank. He was like not making sense and he was saying that his family was in danger. He was wearing his scrub top that was covered in blood. And then in April, the next month, he shoplifted from Walmart. So he now had these like outside of his operating crimes, he had these other like charges. And there was a new DA in Dallas, Michelle Shugart, and she's played by Anna Sophia Robb in the show. And she has a pretty big part in the show, but she wanted to take on this case. And unlike the other district attorneys that Kirby and Henderson tried to get their attention, she really wanted to like persecute him. And she realized that because Mary Eford was over 65, that would increase like the charges in the prosecution because that was like abuse of an elderly person. But at this point, they only had 4 months before the statute of limitations would run out on that charge. So she had to work like really quickly to indict him. But they used that email that he wrote to his coworker and girlfriend like years ago that said he was going to become a cold-blooded killer. And they were able to indict him in July of 2015. And in 2017, again, another 2 years later, he was convicted and he was sentenced to life in prison.
Thanks.
So, I know. And at the end of the podcast, they talk about like if there is another Dunge, you know, like this may not be the only time we hear of something like this. I mean, hopefully not to this extent, but they talk about, you know, is he a sociopath? Is he like what is it about him that made him do this? Like, what was the reasoning? I mean, not the reason, but you know, the cause, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's terrifying. It's terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying. It's kind of like the women, like nurses that the one woman nurse I talked about, and you kind of hear it more like there's several stories about, nurses doing things like that, and it's like they like the power of having someone's life in their hands. But I mean, he was just botching that. Just he wasn't even trying to be sneaky with
and
what he was doing.
A little bit of them questioning him, and he, like, in these instances, they ask specifically about these people and their operations, and he says, oh, well, it went mostly normal. There was just some small complications. And it's like, she bled out in the recovery room, and, like, you screwed random holes in her spine. Like, what are you talking about? Are you delusional? But, I mean,
yeah, that's not normal at all.
Yeah, and then you just think, like, when you go to the doctor, you are, like, you trust that they are the expert and they will keep you safe and will do what they need to do. And I mean, I've had many like operations, and I feel like I'm always at the doctor, and I'm like, now I go and I'm like, oh my God, like there could
you
be
need
one
to do
of
some background checks.
Yeah, I know. But like his background checks were like clean because he hadn't been reported. He hadn't been put on that like data bank list. He had like recommendations from his whoever like oversaw him in residency. So
yeah, it's scary. Yeah. I forget how crazy that story is and all the little details.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I'm doing Thing About Pam, which is a Dateline NBC story, and there's now a show on Hulu that was just released. A couple of people in the TV show, it has Renee Zellweger, Katie Mixon, which I recognized her from American Housewife, which is some like sitcom, and then Josh Duhamel is in it, but I didn't know that. I don't know who he plays. I didn't watch enough of it to figure that out. But those are a few people who were in the show. I couldn't get, it was kind of cheesy. I couldn't get into it, but maybe.
Even just the ad for it looked.
Yeah, it's not.
Does Katie Mixon, whatever her name is, does she have that like weird southern voice in the show?
Yeah, I think so.
I have so many people I don't like, but like I can't say, she talks like this.
Oh my God.
You can cut that out. You got to cut that out.
Okay. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It was bad. It was not good. So I liked the podcast, though. So the podcast was released in 2019. It was hosted by Keith Morrison, which we love Keith Morrison. He's like the best. Do you know who he is?
Yeah, he's got a great voice.
Oh, he's amazing. And he also does some of the TV. Like he does some of the narrating in the TV.
Is he the one whose daughter was like missing or something?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so. But he's been a correspondent for Dateline for 25 years. And there's actually 5 Dateline NBC episodes on The Thing About Pam. So there's, I mean, there's like their actual TV shows and then they have the podcast. So on to the story, which I'm sure many of you know this story, but we will talk about it again. So on December 27th, 2011 in Troy, Missouri, Russell Fieri, I think is how you say his name, comes home to find his wife dead, Betsy. There's blood everywhere. She had been stabbed, and Russ believed Betsy killed herself, just like based on his first initial, you know, look at her. So he calls 911, and he's in a full panic. They play this call at the very beginning of the podcast, and later, like many people think he was faking his emotions on this call because they're just like, it's too much. So, Russ was the prime suspect initially. He was interrogated for 2 days, and basically this was his alibi. The day Betsy was murdered, Russ had worked until 5 p.m. He called her once he got off work and asked if she needed a ride because she was at her mom's house, I think. Betsy said no, her friend was going to give her a ride home, Pam. Russ ran errands for about an hour. Then he went to a game night at his friend's house around 6 p.m. and they had this game night, I think, like every Tuesday or something. He left his friend's house around 9 p.m., stopped for something to eat, and got home around 9:45 and then called 911 around 9:40. So, like, his timeline matched the 911 call. So, even though he had an alibi, detectives still believed he was a prime suspect, which is normal. They're always going to look at, like, the person closest to you. So they learned that Betsy had been stabbed over 56 times, and they were like, okay, like they didn't believe his suicide assumption because obviously that wasn't suicide. They said it was a crime of passion, and like she had even been stabbed after she had died. And then on January 4th, 2012, Russ was arrested for the murder. So they also interview Pam, because Pam Hubb, because she is the one who gave Betsy the ride home. And in her interview, she's in total shock, and she had known Betsy for a decade. They worked together at an State Farm insurance. That night, Pam had told Betsy she would pick her up from her mom's house and bring her home. Told police that Russ and Betsy had been separated 6 or 7 times. Said he was not nice to her verbally, so like she was like, no, they don't have a happy marriage, and Russ was like, yeah, we did have a happy marriage. So she and I guess she said that he made comments about how much money he would make after she passed away, and told police Betsy was planning to tell Russ she wanted to move in with her relatives and rent out their home in Troy to save money, and she was afraid Russ would not like this idea. Police confronted Russ with this idea, and he said he had never been told that, so kind of weird. Pam told investigators that they would play a game, like Russ and Pam, where Russ would put a pillow on her face to see what it would feel like and then say he was joking, which they confronted. Like, I don't think this was true. I think this was something that Pam made up. So there was not a ton of crime in Lincoln County. In the 3 years before Betsy was murdered, there had only been two murders. The first murder trial for the judge. This was the first murder trial for the judge, and the prosecutor had never had a case like this. And it just basically they point that out to say, like, okay, there was some shortcomings with this investigation. So I'm going to give y'all, like, I love that I just said, I'm going to give y'all, like, I have an audience that I'm talking to. It's
okay, everybody. Story time.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay. Prosecution. This was the prosecution. Oh, my God. This was the prosecution side of the story. The 911 call, they found it, like, overdramatic and faked. Betsy's family believed this, too. There had been fights between Russ and Betsy. The cops were called once. The family knew there was issues, causing them to believe that they got in a fight and he was enraged and killed her. And they basically were just making, like, small things, like, into big things. They had Pam take the stand. She made the pillow comment and said Russ was degrading and made people feel uncomfortable. The physical evidence they had was blood on the, like, there was blood on his slippers, on the light switch, in the closet, and in the kitchen. There was semen found inside Betsy the night of the murder. There was no blood on him. Must have been naked. Like, had sex, was naked, then killed her, and then got in the shower. It was kind of their, like, their story. Purposely covered his track with the alibi. They interviewed his friends from the game night, saying that they had rehearsed what they were going to say. So basically the prosecution was, like, incriminating, like, his four friends too. So, I mean, they just were, like, throwing everybody under the bus. So the closing statement, the lawyer believed he had planned this, told his friends about it, left his phone at his friend's home, had sex with her, killed her, then showered, put his slippers on, got blood on them, so he puts them back in the closet, waited for the friend to return the cell phone, and then called the police. So, that's basically the prosecution side. The defense side of the story. From the start, Russ's lawyer believed he was innocent, obviously, but so did Dateline. Like, they just knew some things were off with this case. The person, like, basically his lawyer was like, someone who was calling this a suicide would be dumb to call it a suicide if they had actually done it, because there was 56 stab wounds. So, like,
yeah, like, come up with a better story. Like, that's not even exactly believable if that's what you're going to use an
excuse. Yeah, and so she was covered in blood, and so the only things that were, like, the only stab wounds that were visible were the ones to her neck and wrist, so that's why they believe he thought that. Also, Betsy had attempted suicide 2 or 3 times before, so, like, that's probably where he just went immediately. Betsy had breast cancer on and off, so she had gotten it, recovered, and then got it again. I think it was basically, like, terminal the second time around. And, yeah, it was stage 4 and terminal. And they were like, why would he kill her if she had terminal cancer? Like, she's gonna die. You know, mm-hmm. like, it just didn't make mm-hmm. sense. So, there's also some evidence there, or Russ's lawyer, like, goes through some of the prosecution's evidence and, like, debunks it. So, the blood on the slippers, they believe, were staged, dipped in the blood, and put back in the closet. There was no footprint of the slippers in the blood. On the splotches, there was only splotches of blood on the bottom and the side. So it looks like they literally just, like, dipped it and put it back. Like, you would think if you were wearing them, there would be footprints. The blood on the light switch in the same closet had Betsy's DNA from the blood and someone else's, which they could never determine who. So that's a big red question, or I mean, mm-hmm. red flag. The pillow on Betsy's face, her mother stated that she never heard of Russ ever doing that, and they were really close, so they don't think that was true.
Yeah, my mom would know. She knows everything.
Yeah. And then the crime of passion, they just said, like, many of the wounds were the same amount in death, and they came from the same area, so there was, like, no irregularities, meaning they, like, made it, they tried to stage it to look like a crime of passion. So it was like she literally just sat there from the same angle and just tried to make it look like it was a crime of passion. Russ had 4 alibi witnesses and cell phone data tracking his location. Rigor mortis had set in by the time he found her, and she had been dead for a couple of hours. There was only 8 sperm found in Betsy, and they had sex Sunday night, and she died Tuesday night, meaning that 8 sperm could still be present, so they didn't have sex that night. Evidence proved no shower was taken that night. They, like, pipes were tested. Russ's lawyer had an alternative suspect, but could not use the evidence in court because the judge said it was irrelevant. Russ was found guilty on first-degree murder and would serve life in prison. So, obviously, the other suspect is Pam. And here's some reasons why she, the lawyer was getting suspicious of her. The family, after Betsy died, the family was trying to use the money from the life insurance policies to cover the funeral expenses, and during this time, they found out that there was a $150,000 policy on Betsy that Pam had received 4 days before she was murdered. One of the policies was switched from Russ's name to Pam's name. And when they switched it over, they did not go to a notary. They went to a local library and basically just asked this woman to sign this form, and she did. Pam said this was Betsy's idea. She said she wanted her to have it so she could help Betsy's daughters out after she was gone. Trusted she could handle the money. And, Russ would be too distraught to be able to handle it. The insurance company called the police to ensure Pam wasn't a suspect in the murder. They said no, and the insurance company gave her the money. So, when the family found out Pam had gotten that money, they wanted to use it on the funeral, and she said no. Why should Betsy pay for her own funeral when her husband killed her? So she put $100,000 in a trust for Betsy's daughters. She revoked the trust right after Russ was convicted. And then she said she gave the remaining $50,000 to a struggling family she knew. So, yeah. During a later interview, she says she doesn't recall that promise she made. So, very sketch. Yeah. Russ's lawyer filed a motion to a new hearing and won. The defense's evidence in the second trial was Pam's cell phone records. And so when Pam and Betsy arrived to Betsy's home, Pam called her husband to tell them that they, or to tell him they made it to Betsy's, which is very odd at the time, but she was trying to establish her alibi. Pam then called Betsy's phone to tell her she had made it home. The timestamps did not match with the amount of time it would have taken her to get home. They believe she made the call from Betsy's neighborhood. So, like I said, she was trying to create an alibi. Russ took a polygraph test, when they first interviewed him, and it wasn't recorded. And audio and video are supposed to be taken on polygraph tests, so that was a big red flag. The lead investigator told Pam to open the trust for the girls before the trial, to help her case. So, literally, the police investigator was, giving her tips. They did a luminol test, and when they took pictures from the luminol test, the camera wasn't working, and so the pictures came out, black. So, the pictures from the crime, they did that on purpose because, basically, it wasn't supporting their investigation. The crime scene wasn't.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. Russ's story never changed, and Pam's interviews were inconsistent. They changed over time. Prosecution defense in the second trial, they still said it was a crime of passion. Russ was violent. They said this was something new. They said Pam and Betsy had an affair with Russ, and Russ was jealous. They were just throwing things out there. And they tried to do this because it would make sense for Betsy to give Pam the money. And then they were how was this not mentioned in the first interview? This only came up 3 years later. Supposedly, a letter was written to Pam from Betsy about giving her the money and their relationship, but the author of that letter was unknown. They tracked it down on the computer. So, it's like someone planted the letter.
Mm-hmm.
Russ was found not guilty in the second trial in November of 2015. After this, Betsy's daughters brought Pam to civil court over the insurance money She was a hostile witness. Like, she wasn't answering the questions directly, and she was going in circles. However, like, the judge still didn't force her to turn the money over to the girls because there was no proof that Betsy specifically said to give the money to the girls. So, just not good. In August of 2016, Pam calls 911 saying there was an intruder and she had shot him 5 times. So when police investigate the scene, there were red flags. There was no forced entry. There had been a piece of carpet cut out and the man was conveniently laying on top of that. So it was placed there to protect the good carpet. So very weird. $900 bills were found in the man's pocket. Some of the bills were matched to a $100 bill in Pam's room, like the numbering. So they came from the same batch. Mm-hmm. They found in the man's pocket, there was a note with instructions that said, kidnap Pam, get Russ's money from Pam, then kill Pam. And they were trying to say Russ set this up. And Russ went straight to the police and got his alibi cleared. And he also provided a note to prove that he did not write that note found in the man's pocket. And the police said the 911 call sounded scripted, like the one Pam made about the intruder. Mm-hmm. So when they interviewed her, they said she was very casual for someone who just shot somebody who had entered their home. Like, you think you would be, like,
shaken.
Yeah, adrenaline running through, you know. She said she was backing out of her driveway when someone pulled up behind her really fast. They got out of this car and hopped into Pam's, pulled a knife on her, and said, take me to the bank and to get Russ's money. She said the guy wasn't alone. There was a driver in the other car, and she was basically saying the driver looked like Russ. She escaped the car, ran into her home. The attacker followed her. She called 911 and then fired the gun. The police thought this whole thing, like, again, sounded scripted. Police identified the attacker as Lewis Gumberger. They spoke to Lewis's mom, and she said he did not have the mental capacity to do something like this, and he did not have the physical capacity to even run. He had been in a car accident years before that left him with really bad brain damage. So they were like, okay, what's the connection between Pam and Lewis? So by searching Pam's phone, they learned that from her location history, she had been driving through low-income neighborhoods for weeks, basically searching for a target. She stopped at Lewis's apartment complex, goes from there right back to her house. So, like, they had her location where she literally picked him up and brought him to her house. Mm-hmm. They also had her on video stopping at a bakery outside her neighborhood, and he was in the passenger seat. So, like, just the worst. Like, they were like, this is literally, like, a middle schooler came up with this idea. Like, this is so bad.
Yeah.
So, they were like, okay, how did she get Lewis in her car? Well, they got a tip from this woman named Carol Alfred. Carol was at her home with her dog outside, and a woman drove by and came back. She got out of the car. She asked Carol, do you babysit? And Carol's thinking, like, why is a stranger asking some other stranger in a trailer park that? She said she was a producer from Dateline and her name was Kathy. Well, the actual producer working on this Dateline story was named Kathy. And the Kathy woman was like, what the hell? So, she was like, excuse me? So, told her some story that Dateline was reenacting 911 calls and had rented a trailer in the park. And told her she would give her $1,000 up front and then $1,000 when they're done. And Keith Morrison is like, okay, one, we don't reenact 911 calls, and two, we don't pay people for interviews, but okay. So she had Pam pull into her driveway where, like, the security cameras on her house would capture the license plate, and she got into the car with her and was like, okay, I'll go with you. And then she gets in the car and she asks Pam for an ID, and she's like, oh, I'll show you later at this place by the mall. And then Carol was like, okay, that's a different location than what she just told me. So she, like, makes up some line, gets her to bring her back home. And so she goes back in her house and calls 911. And so later they bring her in to interview and she points Pam out in a lineup. So they were like, okay, she basically used the same tactic on Lewis and it worked and he ended up dead. At that point, they go and arrest Pam in August of 2016. After she was arrested and during her interview, she tried to commit suicide. She asked to go to the bathroom, like you can see, or they say on camera, she like takes the pen off the desk and then asks to go to the bathroom and then like starts stabbing herself like in the neck and in her on her wrist. Shortly after she was arrested, another county was reviewing the death of Pam's mom. In an interview from the first trial for Betsy, she explains the story of how her mom got in an accident and was put in a home. She told police if she really wanted insurance money, she would just kill her mom instead of Betsy, because Betsy was someone who could fight back. So, yeah. In 2013, Pam's mom had died from falling from the balcony of her third floor apartment. It was ruled an accident at the time. She was prone to falling. But, of course, Pam was the last person to see Shirley alive. So, they got a tip that they should reinvestigate. And they did, and they still didn't find, like, anything. They still thought it was an accident. And the police never interviewed Pam during any of those, initial investigations. They did talk to her brother, and he said he didn't have any concerns. Like, he assumed, like, she just fell. Well, they had questions about the railing because, like, Shirley didn't fall over the railing. She, like, fell to the ground with, like, she fell through the railing. Like, the railing went with her. And they were like, you would literally need, like, a lawnmower to, like, push through the railing for it to, like, break. You know, or, like, someone kicking it. You don't just...
Yeah, the force to go through it with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Knock it out. Yeah.
Yeah, and at the time of her fall, Shirley had 14,000... sorry. 14 times the amount of Ambien in her system.
I don't know. That'd be a lot. Ambien. That's what I need to sleep at night.
I know. 14,000. I'm still thinking numbers in my head. They changed the death ruling from accidental to undetermined, but I don't think anything has ever happened with that. In August 2018, Lincoln County voted the prosecutor and the judge who was involved in the murder case of Betsy, like, out. And the case has been reopened with a new prosecutor named Mark Wood. And he believes that DNA that I told you was on the light switch, well, that was a male's DNA, but they don't know who. So he thinks there might have been an accomplice. So they're trying to, like, reopen that case of Betsy because the prior prosecutor and judge, like, after Russ was found not guilty the second time around, they would never prosecute anyone because they didn't think... They thought it was Russ. So her case was basically just, like, open. And, you know, like, there was no... They mm-hmm. weren't going to find... They weren't going to convict anybody. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so in June of 2019, Pam takes an Alford plea, or guilty plea, for the murder of Lewis. And that basically means she's acknowledging that the state's evidence is so overwhelming that had she gone to trial, there would be no doubt she was convicted. But she never, like, admitted to the murder, which is kind of, you know, that... It's annoying for a lot of the family members. In July of 21, she was interviewed in connection with the murder of Betsy for the first time. And later Wood charged her with first-degree murder of Betsy. And this is actually not in the podcast. I, like, went to Wikipedia to find, like, what was going on today. Pam entered a not guilty plea. A preliminary hearing was scheduled for February of 2022, but was delayed after Pam's public defender died of a heart attack. So, right now she's spending time in jail for Lewis's murder, but I do think they will try to convict her for Betsy's murder with the new prosecutor. Yeah. So, crazy story.
Literally everyone who comes into contact with her.
Yeah, they were like, what are the odds that... You were the last person to see three people alive and they're all dead. Yeah, like the prosecutor was like, I've literally never been the last person to see someone alive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's,
you know,
that's bizarre. I was thinking, but this couldn't be it. I was like, I wonder if Lewis was her accomplice because that would be, you know, it would be convenient for her to kill the only other person who knew that she did it.
Point.
But they would have his DNA, so they would have been able to match that.
True. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, that is a...
She's crazy.
Pam, man.
The thing about Pam.
I think we're out of it a little bit.
Yeah, we're, I don't know.
It's some, the end of the
some
week.
Something's
wrong. But anyway, so yeah, those are a couple of good podcasts that have been turned into TV shows. Mm-hmm. You know, that might be your thing. It's not my thing, but I still love the podcast. So,
yeah,
you know, yep. Give it a try. Give it a shot. See what you think. You probably already heard these stories because, I mean, these are like, I feel like very popular. Old and popular, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, anyways, I think that's it. I don't have anything else.
Until
next time.
Next time.
All right. Bye, Sam.
Bye, Ashton.
Thanks for listening to In Search Of. Don't forget to review, subscribe, and follow our podcast to stay up to date on the latest episodes.
If you want more information on In Search Of, you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.